Returning to where we ended our review of Paul's opening statement yesterday, I would be remiss if I did not draw your attention again to the placeholders. Now, in this particular case, Paul used the placeholder for Yahusha. I shouldn't say Paul. The letter, the oldest extant copy we have of Paul's letter to the Galatians, which is Papyrus 56, a very late 1st century, early 2nd century codex that includes most all of Paul's letters, in addition to Hebrew, which Paul's disciples wrote. You see it, this codex, which was scribed in Alexandria, replete with the divine placeholders. And before we get back in focus on what these placeholders represent, note that it is highly likely, almost certain, if you're rational, thoughtful, informed, to realize that Paul himself did not use the placeholders. You see, the Septuagint was initially written in Alexandria, in the scribal houses in Alexandria. And it was in Alexandria that Jews who were a significant part of the population of Alexandria in the 2nd and 3rd century BCE wanted a translation of the Hebrew Torah in Greek, because they had become more fluent in Greek than they had in Hebrew. And it was largely due because of Alexander the Great's conquest of Egypt, which, by the way, essentially capitulated. It wasn't much of a fight in Egypt. So they wanted to create a Greek translation of the Hebrew Torah, and did so in the range of, began the work somewhere around 250 to 275 BCE. And when they did so, all of the initial translations translated all of the words, but none of the names and titles. The names and titles they retained in Hebrew, in the Hebrew alphabet, because they could not be transliterated, which means to replicate the sound in Greek using the Greek alphabet. And the rule on translation has been known and followed by most responsible parties for millennia. You translate words, which means to convey the meaning of the word in one language in the new language. And you transliterate names, which means Osama bin Laden is Osama bin Laden in Arabic and French and English and German. His name doesn't change based upon a different language. Now, sometimes we don't have the sounds in one language to properly replicate the sounds in another language, at which point in names of certain individuals, we will alter them to come up with something that's somewhat close. But when you're dealing with God's name, coming up with something that's somewhat close and losing all of the insights that the original alphabet and the original language conveyed wasn't something that was appropriate to do. So those who were the first to translate the Hebrew text into Greek left the Hebrew names, Yahweh's name, Yahusha's name, all of the names of the prophets, like Yeshaya, in Hebrew. And they even left the titles in Hebrew, because the titles all have meaning in Hebrew. For example, Masayah means the work of Yahweh. Yisrael means individuals who engage and endure with God. And if you just transliterate them, then you lose the words which comprise the meaning. So they didn't do it. Yahusha, for example, if you transliterate it using the letters of a different language and you don't carry any of the of the Hebrew background with you, you would never have a way of knowing that Yahusha is actually an identity designation and a mission statement. It means Yahweh saves. And so that's how they handle it. So when Paul's letters showed up in a scribatorium in Alexandria, they knew that not only was the Septuagint universally devoted initially to conveying the Hebrew names in Hebrew, and then over time, over a course of about 300 to 400 years, after the initial translation of the Hebrew Torah into Greek, maintaining the names in Hebrew, they began to use Greek placeholders for the Hebrew names and the Hebrew titles. And these Greek placeholders showed where to look for the name without misrepresenting the name. And so when Paul's letters arrived in Alexandria, and they had also at this time scribed many copies of Matanyah and Yahochanan, the two disciples, the only two eyewitness accounts that we have apart from what's written in prophecy. They saw that they used the placeholders. So they wanted Paul's letters to look like the rest of it so that he would have the credibility of that was associated with writings and placeholders that they were put in at that time. Now, the placeholders for Ayushu, Yahusha, for Masayah, for Elohim, for the Upright One, for the Almighty, even for Father and Mother, when Mother and Father are associated with God, they were all conveyed via divine placeholders. Now, examples of the placeholders not used in this opening statement, but ubiquitous throughout the rest of the Greek text, and universally found in every 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and early 4th century manuscript. On every page, every time these words are used. Ruach Spirit, Edom, the upright one, or the upright pillar. As well as Mother and Son, when used in reference to God. Always divine placeholders. Capitalized letters with a horizontal bar over them. Now, there's not one Christian in 100,000, maybe not even one in a million, that knows that these are ubiquitous in all of the oldest manuscripts, and therefore there is no basis for Ayusu or Christu or the pathetic attempts at transliteration of Jesus and Christ. He didn't have a Greek name, didn't have a Greek title. And the Greek name and the Greek title is not written in any of the first 4 centuries of worth of manuscripts. So while codexes dating to the first 3 centuries differ considerably among themselves and differ substantially from those composed after the influence of General Constantine, the use of divine placeholders is the lone exception to the scribal variation between the early manuscripts. These symbols for God's names and title are universally found on every page of every extant codex written within the first 350 years of Yahusha's mission and without exception. But nonetheless, they are universally ignored by ignorant Christian translators, by Christian writers, by Christian preachers. By including them here in the text, as all of the disciples did, it is incumbent upon us to expose and condemn 1,700 years of religious tampering and corruption. The very fact that these placeholders are found on all of the more than 100 manuscripts unearthed prior to the mid and the late 4th century tells us that it wasn't a regional or scribal choice. Instead, they convey something so profoundly important that they were purposefully inscribed throughout the original autographs in the text penned by the authors of these Greek texts. The same technique was used, as I mentioned, in the Septuagint, first pens hundreds of years before these documents were written. And so while these manuscripts differ from one another with regard to their wording, the only consistent thing, the only constant, is the one thing every translator has ignored. There isn't even a footnote in any of our English translations indicating that these divine placeholders were universally depicted in all of the oldest manuscripts, including the Codices, Sinaiticus, and Vaticanus. As a result, Christians do not know that these symbols existed, much less that they were later replaced by translators substituting the very names and titles which would have been written out if the original authors had intended that they be used. Now, for those interested in a comprehensive presentation and analysis of the significance of the divine placeholders, I encourage you to go to the name volume, I think it's volume 2, of An Introduction to God, which you'll find at introtogod.org. Kappa Sigma, Kappa Upsilon, in capital letters with a line over them, were used to convey Yahweh's name and Yahusha's upright one title, even though every English Bible replaces these symbols with the Lord, which according to God is Satan's title, even Satan's name. The fact that Kappa Sigma conveys Yahweh, the preponderance of the time that it is used, is something I discovered when translating Greek quotations of Hebrew passages cited by Yahusha and his disciples. You see, Yahusha, in particular, constantly cited from the Torah, as well as from the prophets and Psalms. And when he cited from them, every time you'll see a citation. Now, he quoted them in Hebrew. They were written in Hebrew. He recited them in Hebrew. And then he spoke about them in Hebrew. But his Hebrew citations were translated into Greek. And every place that his Hebrew citations were translated into Greek, where the Hebrew reads Yahweh, you will find a placeholder, Kappa Sigma, today in the oldest manuscripts. It is absolute proof that Kappa Sigma was used to represent Yahweh's name. We'll be back when Shattering Myth continues after the commercial break. As I mentioned before, there's an absolute obvious conclusion that a rational and informed individual can derive that has been reaffirmed recently by the publication of early Septuagint manuscripts. In all of them, we find a translation from writing Yahweh's name in Paleo-Hebrew, in the midst of the Greek text as the Hebrew was translated into Greek, with exception of Yahweh's name, retaining it in Paleo-Hebrew, throughout the 1st and 2nd century. So this was throughout the 1st and 2nd century BCE, and even throughout the 1st and 2nd century CE. Then this changed to using the symbolism of Kappa Sigma to represent Yahweh's name beginning in the 3rd century. So we know for certain what seemed perfectly obvious. The divine placeholders, Kappa Sigma and Kappa Epsilon, were used to designate Yahweh's name in a language whose alphabet could not replicate its pronunciation. It's as simple as that. You know, the number of times that I get letters from some Nimrod out there that says that they now know how to and can prove the pronunciation of Yahweh's name. I mean, they don't turn to the Hebrew. They don't turn to the word like Torah that provides us information how to pronounce every letter in Yahweh's name. They don't turn to Elohim from Eloah. They don't turn to Shalom to know how to pronounce Yahweh's name. They don't turn even to Haya, which is the verb that Yahweh's name is based on. No, they turn to Greek. And yet, the very existence of the placeholder says you can't turn to Greek because the Greek alphabet could not properly convey the pronunciation of Yahweh's name. So they didn't even try. That's astounding how easily people are misled. You know, you've got the largest Christian denomination on earth, the Roman Catholic Church, expressly condemning the use of Yahweh's name. They don't even know how to pronounce it, and they don't want it used. And yet they're fighting in the courts to replace it with Allah, who is the pagan god that is the guise of Satan in Islam. That's amazing how lost religious individuals are. And it's religious individuals who are responsible for all this because they run the publishing houses that are continuing to promote these myths. By finding Yahweh written in Paleo-Hebrew, in the oldest Greek translations of the Hebrew scriptures, especially in those dating to the 1st and 2nd centuries BCE and to the first 2 centuries CE, we have an interesting affirmation that the logical rationale regarding the divine placeholders is accurate. Yahweh's name can't be accurately transliterated using the Greek alphabet, so to avoid a mispronunciation, the Hebrew alphabet was used. Then after the Hebrew alphabet became less familiar, due in large part to the Romans murdering, enslaving, and exiling most Jews, and burning every copy of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms in Hebrew that they could find, preferring to burn every copy soaked in water wrapped around a Hebrew scholar so as to kill both slowly, torturing them, the Greek symbolism was substituted. There was no other option. Moving on, the placeholders iota epsilon and iota epsilon nu, iota sigma, iota epsilon sigma, iota epsilon, upsilon, I should say, and iota nu were used to convey Yahusha's name every time it is found in the Greek. And that means that there is absolutely no basis whatsoever for the 17th century corruption known as Jesus. I mean, that's why I was so angry at the Graham, Franklin, and Billy for talking about, help your friends and neighbors that don't know Jesus. Franklin Graham's not a nincompoop. When I met with the head of the college that he attended, which is Liberty, and I talked to Jerry Falwell about not only the fact that Franklin Graham attended Liberty University, but that Falwell and the scholars that were the head of the education at the university knew for certain that Jesus was wrong and that Yahusha was right. You don't think for a second that the Grahams don't know that they're lying. They do. They just want your money. These placeholders were found to convey Yahusha's name every time it was written in any one of the Greek manuscripts. So there's absolutely no basis, folks, for the corruption that is written as Jesus. And we'll consider that and what that lie means to so many people when we continue. Folks, it's hard for me to properly emphasize the harm that has been perpetrated on billions of people by promoting the myth that there was an individual named Jesus Christ and that he founded a religion. Billions of people have lost their soul. Billions of people have been beguiled by religious institutions that know better because they want their money. There's very few things that are as egregious as this crime against humanity. I would say that the only crime greater than promoting the myth that there was a person who was somehow associated with God named Jesus Christ is the promotion of the myth that the Lord is God's name, that the Lord is God's title, that God wants to be known as the Lord. In the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, your religious publication knowingly, deliberately, purposefully replaced Yahweh's name all 7,000 times that it appears with the Lord. All 7,000 times. Simply replaced. Not a translation. Not a transliteration. Simply it says Yahweh's name, and they replaced Yahweh's name rather than transliterating. We transliterate beautifully in English. Accurately in English. They simply replaced it with the Lord. Giving, ascribing Satan's name and title to God. The Lord is Satan. Well, second only to that is the basis of the Christian religion and how billions have been fooled into believing there was a Jesus Christ. There was no Jesus Christ. There is absolutely no legitimacy to that name. And if you corrupt his name and you corrupt his title, then you haven't got a clue who he is. You know, there wasn't even a J in the English language prior to the 17th century. And never in the Hebrew, Greek, Aramaic, or Latin languages, Jesus isn't an accurate translation of Iusu, Iusus, Iusun. So there's no J in English prior to the 17th century. And there's never been a J in Hebrew, never been a J in Greek, never been a J in Aramaic, never been a J in Latin. Never been one. There could not have been a Jesus. There's no aspect of Jesus that is accurate. Nothing. And even the end of Iusu, Iusus, Iusun were conceived as a result of Greek gender and grammar rules. But he's not Greek. He didn't speak Greek. His testimony was not in Greek. He didn't cite anything in Greek. He didn't communicate to anybody in Greek. And yet, these religious institutions want to convert his name into a befuddled transliteration of a Greek name that doesn't even appear in the text, leading billions astray so that they will not know him. None of these names was ever written out in the original Greek text. Not once, not ever. It is therefore inappropriate to transliterate something, which means to replicate the pronunciation and the alphabet of a different language, which isn't actually present. So the name Jesus is a colossal fraud, perpetrated, purposefully promoted by religious leaders desiring that they can fleece and control people by separating them from Yahusha and thus from Yahuwah. That's what they're doing. And they're doing it deliberately. They know it. You ought to be angry at them. You ought to distrust everything they have to say. You ought to discard their publications, including the Bible that you think is inerrant, that is grotesquely corrupt. Deliberately. The title Messiah was represented by Chi Rho, Chi Rho Sigma, Chi Sigma, Chi Upsilon, Chi Rho Upsilon, Chi Omega, and Chi Rho Omega, as well as Chi Nu. We'll be talking more about these divine placeholders in a moment. The Hebrew El and Elohim, which is from Eloah, means almighty, means mighty one. It's the closest word in, I mean, the closest translation of that word and title in English would be God. When it's being used of Yahweh, it would be God, capital G. When it's being used of false gods, and Elohim is used of false gods throughout the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, it would be God, lowercase g, false gods. It was conveyed using the placeholders, Theta Sigma, Theta Upsilon, Theta Omega, Theta Nu. And while God's name and title are not interchangeable, there are times when these placeholders represent Yahweh instead of his title God. Ruach is another, the feminine Hebrew noun for spirit. Without exception, the set-apart spirit's title throughout the Greek historical and eyewitness writings was conveyed using the placeholders Pi Nu Alpha, Pi Nu Sigma, Pi Nu Iota. Just as Yahweh is our Heavenly Father, the Ruach Kodesh is our spiritual mother. In addition to these two names and three titles, the noun and verb forms of upright pole and to affix to an upright pillar were rendered sigma rho omega sigma and sigma rho omega followed by mu alpha iota to indicate the verbal form, both with a line over them to signify divinity, making sure that we wouldn't miss the divine connection between the upright pole and the upright one, the Edon of the Torah. Staros was never written out in any Greek text. Staros is the basis, is the actual Greek word, which if it had been written out, should have been translated upright pole or upright pillar, that's what it means, but was changed by the Roman Catholics to cross. There is no cross written, not even a word remotely close to cross written in the Greek manuscripts. And a placeholder was used to associate the Staros, the upright pole, the upright pillar, with the upright one, the Edom in the Torah, the upright pillar of the tabernacle that makes the tabernacle more secure, that raises the roof to make the tabernacle larger. That's who the upright one is, the one who stood up with us, for us, so we could stand with him. All of that was lost when the Roman Catholic Church decided to change the placeholder for Staros to Staros, and then rather than render it upright pillar, which is what it means, to replace it with cross. And then now Christianity has its symbol. Constantine could claim that he saw the vision of a cross flaming before his God, the Son. And myths were born. So you have Christians saying, don't deny the power of the cross. Christians thinking that something marvelous happened on a pagan cross. In reality, the death stake, the upright pillar upon which he hung, wasn't a cross as in the Christian symbol at all. In fact, the horizontal piece set right on top of the upright pillar. The upright pillar never moved. You know, this picture of Roman Catholics carrying their cross on their shoulder. Bull. The upright pillar was lodged in the limestone. It never moved. It was never discarded. It just stayed there in the limestone. All they did was affix the individual's hands to a smaller horizontal beam, and then they set the horizontal beam on top of the upright pole. Created a capital T, not the Christian cross. Even the symbolism is wrong. And even if you go there and you talk about cross, now you're dealing with the pagan symbol of Tammuz and the Babylonian religion, which the symbol of the cross was used for him, and it was carried throughout pagan religions, particularly Mithraism, which was the religion of the Roman legions and Pope Constantine. That when you do that sort of thing, you convey lies. You've been lied to as a Christian if you think there was a cross. No such thing. It was all lost when the Catholic Church ignored the placeholder and then changed the reference to suggest that it signified a pagan cross. And this is indicting because it means that the Christian Church, and by the way, there's no reference to any word even remotely akin to church in the eyewitness accounts, ignored what was actually written. And then deliberately and knowingly changed the meaning of what had been conveyed. And you might say, I'm not a Roman Catholic, so it's not my problem. Well, your Protestant church took the poison, whole, swallowed it. You got crosses all over your Protestant churches, all pagan, all errant, all missing the point. The cross was a common religious symbol used throughout antiquity in Babylon, Egypt, Greece, and Rome to signify the intersection of the constellation Taurus, the bull representing their god, with the sun during the vernal equinox. The closest sun day to this event was called Easter by these pagans who believed that the sun impregnated Mother Earth on this day, giving birth 9 months later on the winter solstice, then December 25th, to the son of the sun. Solar worship, known as Sol Invictus, the unconquerable sun, was thereby incorporated into Constantine's new religion, Christianity, where it remains to this day. this process began with his alleged vision of a flaming cross superimposed on the sun, which was his god, along with the satanic edict under this sign, conquer. Beyond these on these universal placeholders, we also find Father when it is used in reference to our Heavenly Father, Mother when it is used in reference to our spiritual mother, and Son when designating Yahusha, rendered in the same format in most all early manuscripts. And what I find especially affirming is that the title Mother was designated by a divine placeholder in the Codex Sinaiticus when Yahusha discussed the real meaning of the second of seven instructions that he had etched on the second of two tablets. We'll consider this and more when we return to the final segment of Shattering Myths. During the commercial break, Aaron had sent me a link to a story. Another listener of the program had sent me the story via a video link, and this particular one that was sent to me by Aaron has text. If you're listeners to this program and you want to email me a story that you'd like me to cover, it is to yada@yadaya.com, yada, Y-A-D-A, which means to know, at yada, to know, yah, Y-A-H.com. I'd appreciate it if whatever you want me to comment on is in writing versus video. I really dislike watching videos online. They take forever, and then you got to type in what is said. You got to play it back several times to make sure you've got it accurately. And with text, I can read it not only seven times faster than I can listen, but I can copy and paste it into a document that I can use. And so anyway, he sent me a written article on the fact that in Baghdad now, Shiite women are being given guns and told to defend Baghdad against Sunni men. The first image is of this group of 20, I'd have to assume, are women, all in their black tents. I mean, here it is, hotter than hell. I mean, literally hotter than hell in Baghdad this time of year. And these women have been dragged outside, wearing their black tents. I mean, their black tents from head to toe. The only thing they've got is a black mesh in front of their eyes. Otherwise, they're wearing a tent. And so the religion that is oppressing them in this way is now in giving them a gun, and they're told to go kill those who view their religion differently than they do. God, it's pathetic. Huh. No wonder God despises religion. Now, turning to a religion named Christianity and its basis, Christ, and the improper title's appearance in English translations of Galatians 1:1. It turns out that the overscored Greek symbols, Chiro, Chiro Sigma, Chi Sigma, Chi Upsilon, Chiro Upsilon, Chi Omega, and Chi Rho Omega, as well as Chi Nu, weren't based upon Christus, Christos, Christu, Christone, but instead based upon Christus, an entirely different word. And while you might say, so what's the big deal? Oh, don't tell me I can't have my Christianity and my Jesus Christ. Well, the fact is that Christos means drugged. It is the application of drugs. As proof, the one time that it was actually written out in the Greek text, it was used to say that the Laodicean assembly, this would be in Revelation, applied a man-made drug, an ointment in this case, to their eyes. Christus, which is C-R, the chi, rho, but it's E-S-T-U-S, on the other hand, means useful implement. It means upright servant, as well as merciful one. And it was used to depict the good and beneficial work of a moral servant. In this regard, it is quite similar to the implications of Masayah, which is the implement doing the work of Yahweh. As such, it is useful for you to know that HaMasiach, the Masiach, which is the basis for the transliteration, the Messiah, was never written as a title. Daniel used Mashiach as an adjective to convey the realization that Yahweh's messenger would be prepared and would be set apart to serve as an envoy, as a representative, as a messenger. Further, as the name Maaseh and Maaseyah, it was written over 20 times in the Hebrew Torah, prophets, and Psalms. Yes, there's a name. 20 times it's written as Maaseyah, telling us that Yahusha would be the implement doing the work of Yahweh. In this regard, it is not likely that Yahweh would miss the opportunity to associate his work with his name. Likewise, it is unlikely that rabbis who were adverse to Yahweh's name and authority would miss an opportunity to substitute an errant title, especially one without Yahweh's name, thereby disassociating their Mashiach from Yahweh's Maaseyah. We'll think about that in return to this text tomorrow. May Yah bless.